So the other day I was walking down our hallway at our house, and I turned and I looked at the bookcase. Actually, we call it a secretary. It's one of those things with the glass doors, and then it has the thing you can pull down and put the chair, and it has the little cubby holes and stuff. I don't know. But anyway, I looked at it, and behind the glass, I happened to see this picture. Now, this picture is of a very young man named Jim, and it's of a very young woman named Martha, and it's nighttime, and they're coming down some stairs, and Jim has his hand on Martha's arm, guiding her down the stairs, and she has her dress, her wedding dress, pulled up so that she doesn't trip. Jim has a bottle of champagne and a paper bag in his other hand. and Martha is turned toward him, and she's saying something, you know, just to him. And he's just smiling, just a big smile on his face. She doesn't have any wrinkles. As far as I can tell, she doesn't have any fat around her middle. And she doesn't have any gray in her hair at all. He doesn't seem to have bad knees. He doesn't seem to have AFib or any trouble. He seems to be just fine. They look like they are at the beginning of something. Who are those people? Who are they? I just stood there looking at this and remembering. And to my mind came this little apartment in San Diego where the fold-out couch was the bed. And after that, many more apartments and houses that we lived in during Jim's 20 years in the Navy. The joy of our firstborn, who is sitting here this day. And then the joy of our secondborn and our thirdborn. I remembered the city of Charleston and the beauty of that town, the smell of the marsh and the sight of the crane and the sound of the Carolina Wren. I remember what it felt like, the honor of serving our country, even though it was very, very, very hard. And as I continued to look at the picture, I remembered the sun on my face and the clouds in the sky before the storm. And I remember the storm and the struggles. But right in the middle of remembering the storms and the struggles, I remember the scurrying of chipmunks and the smell of pines and the planting of pansies in the yard. I remember the thunder and the whisper of God's call, and everything turned upside down like it was supposed to be. I remembered the death of loved ones and the birth of new ones to love. I remembered the absolute honesty of it all. And I thought about the past, what lied behind, and the future, what lie ahead. And I was reminded of how amazingly beautiful it all is. How hard it is. How wonderful and terrible is this thing that we call life. Y'all know what I'm talking about, don't you? Because you're right there with me. You are there also. But you know what? The older I get, the more I realize that it's all a gift. Every bit of it, every bit of our lives is this gift from God. We don't deserve it. We can't earn it. We don't have to work for it. It is God's gift. Our lives. And they are so short. Paul knew this. I love the scripture that Jim read. He was writing this letter to the Philippians from prison. And yet still he lived in hope. You can hear it by the tone of his voice. He always lived in hope. And the reason was not because of anything that he could do. It wasn't because of who he was. The reason that he lived in hope is something that we know as well. It's not a secret to us. As a matter of fact, we know it by heart. We even said it this morning since we've been sitting in this place. On the third day, he rose from the dead. The power of the resurrection is at the heart of this letter that Paul wrote to the church. Sitting there in prison, Paul seems to have picked up an imaginary picture of himself. I know they didn't have cameras back then, but we're just using our imagination. Somebody drew a picture of him, and he took it out of his pocket and looked at it. And as he looks at it, he remembers his life. And he doesn't dislike anything that he remembers. He was kind of bragging. Did you hear what he said? He said, "If anyone else has reason to be confident in the flesh, I have more. Circumcised on the eighth day, a member of the people of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew, born of Hebrews. As to the law, a Pharisee. As to zeal, a persecutor of the church. As to righteousness under the law, blameless." It's Paul's biography. It's his resume. He's done it all right. He's followed God's instructions to the Jews impeccably. No one was better at being a Jew than was Paul. And he came from good people. Their lives were gifts from God as well, each one of them. We know that, don't we? Because we know their story. We know their story almost by heart, too, how God rescued them from slavery in Egypt. How he protected them and gave them manna and water in the desert as they were making their journey. How God brought them into the promised land and provided them with a place. And not only a place, he didn't just throw them in the land and say, "There you are, have fun." He provided them with a boundary of love, with this covenant of law. And if you look, I mean, just at the Ten Commandments, you can see what love there was in that law that God provided. You can see that everything is there for the people's benefit. Like we told our kids, you know, "This is going to hurt me more than it hurts you. It's for your own good. Steal your neighbor's wife. Even steal her cow." And life will become messier than it should be. If you worship other gods, well, you'll never be able to receive the full blessings of Yahweh if you do that. Even those crazy things that fill up the book of Deuteronomy and Leviticus, they were all rules for health and sanitation and well-being in the land. They were all a gift from God. They were all a place for God's people to be. They were all wrapped up in love and home. So when Paul looks at his picture, he sees only a sense of thanksgiving and gratitude to God. But then something happened to him, didn't it? It was something that didn't take away from who he was. He kept his identity. He remembered what he had done for God, but it was something that changed him to his very core. And it's something that is still in the business of changing us as well. Frederick Buechner is one of my very favorite theologians. I like him because he's easier to read than some of the others. Some are so wordy. It's like, what? You have to read the sentence five times. But Buechner has this beautiful heart and this lovely mind, and you can tell that he's kind, and it shows in his writing. I wanted to share, he writes about his elation that he felt early in his life when he published his first book. You can imagine it would be an elation to publish a book, to have your name and your picture there on the jacket cover and everything, just be a wonderful, wonderful thing. But he said that it was really anticlimactic and forgettable when it actually happened. He worked so hard and he had waited such a long time for this, but what he remembers about signing the contract for that first book in his publisher's office was not the signing at all. It was instead a chance encounter that he had with an old friend just as he was leaving the building. And here's the way he describes it. He says, "What I remember instead is leaving the publisher's office afterwards and running into somebody in the building whom I had known slightly at college. He was working as a messenger boy, he told me, just a messenger boy in the midst of a big publishing company. I was, as I thought, on the brink of fame and fortune. But instead of feeling any pride or sense of superior accomplishment by the comparison, I remember a great and unheralded rush of something like sadness, almost like shame. We've been in college together. Since then, I had been very lucky, and he had not been very lucky. And the pleasure that I might have taken in what had happened to me was all but lost in the realization that nothing comparable, as far as I could see, had happened to him. I wanted to say something or do something to make it up to him, but I had no idea how or what, and ended up saying nothing of any consequence at all, least of all anything about the contract that I had just signed. We simply said goodbye in the lobby, he going his way and I mine, and that was that. All I can say now is that something small but unforgettable happened inside me as the result of that chance meeting. And I can take no credit for it. It was nothing I piously thought my way to. It was no conscious attempt to work out my own salvation. What I felt was something better and truer than I was, or than I am. And it happened, as perhaps all such things happen, as a gift. Something greater and truer than we are. Paul was on his way to Damascus. He'd heard that there was a group there who were part of the Way. The Way was this following of this man named Jesus, a Jewish rabbi who was teaching about God, doing something new, doing something outside the covenant of the law. These folks were claiming that Jesus had been killed, but that he'd come back, that he'd risen from the dead. And Paul was hell-bent to get rid of them, whatever it took. They didn't need that kind of subterfuge and sabotage in the Jewish faith. You can read all about it if you want to in the book of Acts, but I'm just going to summarize it just a little bit. Paul is on his way to take care of business, and he's walking down the road. And this brilliant light just actually knocks him to the ground. I've read that story a million times, but I never read that the light knocked him to the ground. And a voice speaks. And Paul finds himself, this dignified Jew on a mission from God, lying very undignified on the side of the road, having a conversation with, of all people, Jesus. Jesus first. "Saul," which was Paul's name before, "Saul, why do you persecute me, man? Why in the world do you keep resisting God's will in your life?" And then Paul says, "Who are you, Lord?" "I'm Jesus, the one you're persecuting. Now get up and stand on your feet." And in essence, Jesus says, "Yeah, this is me. I am here, the real deal. And I'm pointing you as my servant to tell everyone what you have seen. Jesus said, I'll take care of you. Don't worry. You just figure out a way to tell people about me. For a while, Paul's eyes were like covered in scales. I guess to give him some time to think through this whole thing. This was a big deal. But soon he saw. And soon he knew, and soon he believed. All his works and efforts of self-righteousness and the law, they were still a part of him. He had still been obedient, but now his eyes were open. And now all Paul wants to do is to know Jesus, to experience the risen Christ. Ooh, I'm glad that happened early on. You know, that's our goal as well, isn't it? To experience the risen Christ. To know Jesus better. To trust him. We're talking about this a little bit in Sunday school this morning. How we're studying the book of Revelation, and we said that's the message of Revelation to us as we move forward to simply be Christ's people in the world. To share the love of Christ and to love one another. And everybody agreed, man, that's hard. It's so hard. But that's the message that we are given. We are to know Jesus better, to experience, to have meetings, to have conversation with the risen Christ. Carrie Underwood did a song several years ago. Y'all remember it? Jesus, take the wheel. It's about a young woman who's driving home on Christmas Eve to see her mom and daddy. It's snowing outside, the baby's in the back seat, and she's driving too fast. As a matter of fact, she's been doing everything too fast in her life. She's gotten out of control. Her life has become just nothing but exhaustion. Nothing but turning away from Christ and trying to do it on her own. Suddenly, she skids on a patch of ice, and the car starts spinning out of control, and she didn't know what to do. Nobody said, I don't know what to do either. You're supposed to turn the way that you're spinning, right? Well, she didn't know. And what she did was just lifted her hands in the air, and she sings. She says, Jesus, take the wheel. Take it from my hands, because I can't do this on my own. I'm letting go. So give me one more chance and save me from this road I'm on. Jesus, take the wheel. We're happy for people like that, aren't we? People who've gotten so far out of control and so much trouble in their lives that in their desperation they call for Jesus. And Jesus answers. But the truth is, this is not most of us, is it? This is not the way our lives are. Most of us are just kind of bumping along, day by day, year by year. Like Paul, we do our best. But somehow that power of the resurrection seems to elude us. We can't do anything on our own, but we don't know how to let go and not be on our own anymore. And we move from one year to the next in our lives and the life of the church. But the truth is, sometimes it seems like there are very few changes. We have the same fears. We have the same hatreds. We have the same grudges, the same hurts, the same prejudices, the same disinterest. Sometimes it seems that God is so far away that the world never changes. It just seems to get worse and worse and worse. So we listen to Paul. And Paul says, don't look back. Don't look back. Don't fear the past. Don't hate the past. But don't live there. Just press on. Don't give up. Be patient. And he's reminding us that even when we don't know it, we change every time we encounter Jesus. And my understanding is that that's not on the road, but that's every time that we love another, every time that we accept the love of another. We have this shift of perspective as our life with Christ unfolds. We see ourselves differently. We see others differently. We begin to have the mind of Christ. It's funny, but we become more ourselves as we become more His. We're more authentic and real. Now, our experiences with Christ are not usually an attack of overwhelming life that knocks us to the ground, or a miraculous rescue on Christmas Eve. Our experiences with Christ are more like a cake baking, you know? Or like the yeast rising in the bread. They're more likely to be like Holy Saturday. Y'all know what Holy Saturday is? It's that day after we had Tenebrae service. Picture it in your mind here in the sanctuary. And we've read the Passion story, and we put out all the candles, every one of them, even the Christ candles, so there's no light at all. And then we go home in the dark. We don't speak to one another. We leave the sanctuary, we leave the parking lot, and just go home, and we get in bed, and we sleep. And then we get up and we wait. We dye Easter eggs, or we clean the house, or we iron our Easter dress, or we cook the ham. But it's in those kind of moments that transformation happens. That's when Jesus meets us in this liminal space, the in-between times, when we are waiting for Him. Holy Saturdays are our act of trust and surrender, all mixed up together. There's nothing we can do. There's nothing we can be. And we can know because we know because we know because we know that something is going to happen. And that's what we hold on to. We know that Easter morning is coming. For us, that something is like Frederick Buechner said, small, but unforgettable, something we don't think of, something we can take no credit for, but something that is better and truer than we are. And so we press on. And day by day, we grow more and more like Jesus, even when we don't know it, especially when we don't know it. So I will look often at my picture of that young Jim and Martha, and you'll look at your pictures, and we'll be reminded of how beautiful it all is, how hard it all is, how wonderful and terrible this thing called life is. And we'll remember that God is in the business of raising the dead day by day. Slowly, y'all, slowly. Like a cake bakes and the bread rises. And all God's people said, Amen. Amen.